Good to have you back.
Glad to be back.
Another year, another book?
Another book.
How are City Lights people treating you?
I think they're my favorite publisher. Yes, I like them.
Do you work with Lawrence Berlin?
No, I work with Robert Sherrard.
But is he the editor?
Yes.
But Ferlinghetti was the founder, wasn't he?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, he's there, but I don't work directly with him.
Your early books were published by New Directions.
Right. I think City Lights is sort of the New Directions of this period.
Yeah, I agree.
Because New Directions is sort of doing reprints of older books.
Well, but Garments is not a reprint.
No, I mean New Directions.
Is doing reprints.
Yeah, more reprints. Yeah,
we haven't heard too much from them. I did a lengthy interview with James Laughlin, however.
Oh, yes.
He was your early editor, wasn't
he? He was, yes.
What was it like working with him?
Well, actually, no one was my editor because the books had been published in England, so there's nothing to change.
Well, tell me about Garments of Living Wear. As I was reading it, I had this feeling that it had the same feeling that Malcolm had.
Oh, really? Well,
and
thank you.
Elijah
Thrush. Yeah,
that same,
right.
Same almost mystical.
Surreal, perhaps, mystical, whatever that is.
Yeah. Tell me about the characters in here. And
well, they're all based, maybe I shouldn't say this, they're based on real people, but the people who read it, who are in the book, except one person was not too pleased, but they seem strangely flattered.
Well, you have a lot to say about the state of New York City and also what you call, I believe you call it, the pest.
Yes. Which is AIDS.
Right.
I decided to call it that because, you know, names in America often go out of use. Like, for instance, they used to call a mental disease dementia praecox, and now that's called schizophrenia. So, anyhow, I like the sound of pest and plague better.
Yeah, it's AIDS has kind of a clinical sound to it.
Right.
And when you say pest, it does remind you of the plague.
Of the bubonic plague, yeah. And the Black Death and so on and so forth.
But AIDS is very much like the bubonic plague.
It is, only I think in a way it's more terrible because at least in the bubonic plague you died within a limited period of time, while in this they suffer for years with no real cure.
But in the book your characters seem to die and then come back.
Yes, right.
How did you get the idea for Garments of Living Wear?
Well, for at least 10 or 12 years, I've been, you know, my plays are done off Broadway. And so I got to know many, many actors, especially the off-Broadway actors. And I found their lives quite fascinating. So that was the initial material.
And in the book, the wealthy philanthropist, or I guess he's not a philanthropist per se, decides to fund
right.
a theater.
Right. He's based on a real person. He's now dead. So I could write the book.
Not AIDS, I hope.
Oh, no. No, no. He never had that. He was enormously wealthy, and he was his own philanthropy society, because he was such an individualist. He didn't, you know, like to work with other people.
You say you work with your off-Broadway plays with a lot of actors. Has AIDS become a major factor in that arena?
Yes, I think so. Of course, some of them, I imagine, take drugs, which is very dangerous today.
Also, the philanthropist in the book, the name escapes me, can you...
Edward Hennings.
That's right.
Yes.
He hates New York.
Right.
Despises it.
Well, people think I'm talking through those characters. I'm not, really. That's when they say they don't like something, that's what they said as real people. So...
Yeah, it is a mistake, isn't it, to put words in a writer's mouth,
right.
So to speak.
Because when Shakespeare says it's a life is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I suppose he felt that way sometime, but I don't think you could say that was Shakespeare's philosophy, or that was Shakespeare speaking.
Now tell me about what you have been up to. Now you had mentioned to me that you had had a debilitating eye disease, but you look pretty good now.
Yeah, it's I still have a little problem with the nerves. The nerve endings are still inflamed, but they're gradually getting over that.
What happened?
I caught herpes in my eye, which I'd never really heard of before. But if I hadn't caught it in time, I would have gone blind in that eye.
That, were you rendered completely sightless for a while?
Well, not sightless, but the eye was so inflamed I could hardly use it, you know.
Was it painful?
Oh, yes, terribly. Then you break out in these, you know, like measles or something. So it, and there's not much they can do for it.
Were you on antibiotics? Is that what they prescribed?
Antiviral. But they didn't seem to help me.
Well, how did this affect your work?
Well, I didn't feel like working, you know, because it's so uncomfortable. But Elaine here, she helped me a lot.
So, but you probably also found it difficult to read.
Very. Still have problems with that.
Are you back at your typewriter now?
Oh, yes. Yes.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new novel called The Virago, which is also about New York, or Brooklyn. Yeah. New York and Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And so, working. And then I have finished a full-length play, which the Theater for the New City hopes to do.
Oh, where's that, the Theater for the New City?
That's on 2nd Avenue, near 10th Street.
And they have their
they
own...
did some of my plays last spring.
Uh-huh.
Which were got a wonderful review in the Village Voice.
What about your poetry? You did.
Well, I'm doing a reading at the St. Mark's in the Bowery.
Yeah.
Yeah, that will be published in Holland, the Complete Poems. In English, not in Dutch.
The Complete Poems of James Purdy?
Yeah.
Published in Holland?
Yes. In a limited edition.
How did you swing that?
Well, they approached me. They had read the poems, my Dutch publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why let them appear in America? So I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I wanted to publish them first. So that's the arrangement.
Well, you have published quite a number of your poems in these small, limited
editions,
haven't you?
Right.
Some of them are quite lovely.
Well, thank you.
And easy to read. I mean, they're almost made for reading out loud.
Yeah, I'm reading at, as I say, at St. Mark's, the Poetry Project.
A couple of years ago, you had your poems set to music, didn't you?
Yeah, frequently.
Yeah.
Frequently set to music. Yeah. In fact, I didn't think I was writing poetry until... composer found, he came into my my room where I work, and someone called me downstairs, and he found this sheaf of poems. He said, I didn't know you wrote poetry. And he said, these should all be set to music. He'd been reading them. So that's how it began. The composer is Richard Hundley. But other composers have set them to music also.
You're one of the few writers, and I interview writers almost every week, but you're one of the few who really has set about making writing your life's task, aren't you? Other people
right.
do other things, like
uh-huh.
they might teach or something like that.
Well, I taught briefly, but you see, I rather like talking to the students, but it siphons off your energy terribly. And, of course, they pay nothing, so you might as well be poor without it.
Well, you taught at NYU, didn't you?
Yes, for 1 year.
But wasn't that kind of exhilarating, working with these young writers or potential writers?
No.
Well, in fact, I was, John Updike probably knows some of his work. He was telling me that he taught creative writing briefly at Harvard over a summer. And when he was finished, he was exhausted, and he said, frankly, he didn't think the student's work was any worse than his own. He thought it was so good, you know, he could have written that. So,
I don't think you can teach people to write. You can teach them you know, grammar and sentence structure and mechanical things, you know, like if you write a short story, it should be about one thing, should concentrate on one thing. But beyond that, I don't think you can teach people to write.
Well, how did you learn?
I think I learned by reading other writers, and I never had a teacher that helped me. In fact, I remember in high school, until I met one teacher, they didn't like what I wrote. They were like the critics. He said, well, these people are unpleasant, you know, you shouldn't write about them. Or depressing, or too funny, you know, the same things that I got later from the critics. In other words, you shouldn't be you, you should be someone else.
Well, I happen to know that many of the critics love you, and in fact, the review of Garments of Living Wear in the Sunday New York Times was an excellent review.
Yes, that was very good.
Now, so
by Bertha Harris, I
don't remember who did it, but you, it's really kind of hard to lump all critics in one
spot. Oh, no, I don't mean that, but I mean there are many wonderful critics in America, but they are seldom asked to review. They seem to often assign the book to someone who just isn't sensitive to what I'm doing.
Well, that's a problem. What I hate are these gratuitous reviews that are lacerating for no particular reason.
Right. Well, and I've gotten many of those.
Well, every writer does.
Yeah, well.
And you just wonder, what's the purpose of it? I mean, it's almost as though the critic is attacking the writer personally.
Right. Well, he is.
But what's the purpose of it? I don't understand.
I don't know. There are many vicious critics. I won't mention them, but they are. They're really hateful. And after I digest these hateful reviews, I realize they've said nothing about the book or about me. The review is about their lives and their point of view.
Now, their biases.
Their biases. Yeah. And they feel you should just write about people they know. But I'm sure that if I knew those people, I wouldn't write about them the way they would like them to be written about.
Well, as you know, I published a small book last year.
And right. That was when I was nearly blind, so I wasn't able to do it justice.
Well, it wasn't a very good book. I can understand that, but it was an effort, first effort. You know,
I thought a person
who's been in journalism all of his life, all of a sudden, I feel like I'm 22 years old and just starting. But the reason I brought up this matter about the critics is that the Baltimore Sun reviewed this thing in a four-column review, and it was savage.
Oh,
I mean, the guy didn't even know me or anything, and the best thing he said was Swaim's writing was serviceable enough.
Oh, whatever that means.
Whatever that means. But I when I read it, I was almost shocked at the anger and hostility that this guy exposed in this review, and I wondered what's the I realized that Mencken, this book was about Mencken, was part of Baltimore, but I mean, what is the purpose of doing something as mean?
No.
I mean, it was really mean, evil review.
Yeah, well, I've gotten many of those. My first book, when I was fairly young, I got this vicious review. I was really so sick I was ready to go to bed. And then you digest it after a while, and you see that this review has nothing to do with you or your book. It's by some angry, twisted person.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I was talking to he's in his 40s, a writer named Thomas Sanchez. He has a new book out published by Knopf called Mile Zero. And about 2 years ago, he published a book called The Zoot Suit Murders, about the Hispanic gangs in California in the 1940s. And the reviewer in the Los Angeles Times gave him a savage, savage review.
Oh.
And he couldn't figure out exactly why. And then he realized that several years earlier, when he published his first book in the Knopf catalog, they gave him a full page. And the reviewer of the Zoot Suit Murders also had a book coming out in the Knopf catalog but was on a page with about 8 other writers.
Oh, I see.
And so Sanchez was trying to think, why would this guy be so vicious? And then he realized that it was had nothing to do with the book. As you just said, it had something to do
with him.
Professional rivalry or jealousy.
Yeah. Well, I don't like to review books. I don't do it because, well, it's just not my métier.
But you can review a book in an objective, reasonable way without can't you?
Sure.
And then you can do the book, the author, and the public some justice.
Right. But you can't review a book in rage or hatred. You can't write novels that way either. If you're angry with your characters, I mean, it's ridiculous. You can't do that.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. People who write in order to deliver a message.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the old expression, if you wanted to deliver a message, go to Western Union. somehow you can deliver a message in a subtle way in your work.
Right.
But to sit out there and say, perhaps, I'm going to tell the people what Washington, D.C. is really like in his novel. Somehow those novels never work.
No. You have to digest all of this, you know, what you're going to write. So you get some... Well, I think Wordsworth said that poetry was emotion remembered in tranquility. And that's sort of true of all writing. You have to have a distance between you and your subject.
Yeah, I think you... And you have to have an objective way of approaching the way you're going to write so that you are able to communicate the character's point of view,
right,
or to be able to deliver a plot line that's successful, or to be able to write a coherent sentence.
Right. You have to let the character be born and then be himself in your work. The writer has to retreat then and let the character take over.
Your characters in Garments for the Living Wearer are born out of a lot of the off-Broadway theater work that you are involved in, but over the years, your characters, do they pretty much resemble the people that you know and people around you?
Well, they recognize themselves and say so. I guess I'll have to take their word for it. But actually, for instance, one of the leading characters in this novel, now her women friends say that she's exactly like that. And yet nothing that happens to that character in the book ever happened to her. So that's rather interesting, I think. When, as I say, when the character begins to emerge from your own hands, it becomes, you know, it becomes it. It's born. And the writer just has to let it be. I know once Unamuno, the Spanish writer, said one of his characters came and called on him one day and criticized him for not presenting himself correctly.
Well, I would suspect that you might have the germ of a character based on someone you met. I mean, you don't live in a vacuum, so we all have to do things like that. But you do develop the character, and indeed, as you just mentioned, this woman you put in a different plot line. A lot of the quirks and personality characteristics may be the same, but I have a feeling that you go further, and I also have a feeling that probably characters are composites anyway.
Right. Also, I find with very interesting people that you might think are outrageous, that I couldn't put down everything they are and do. Not that I'm afraid to, but they're just so complex that you have to simplify them, or you couldn't get them into a book. That means a lot of omissions. So you try to just, so to speak, boil them down to their quintessential reality. But if you put everything down, no one could read it. It'd all be these details and complexities.
What's your relationship with Weidenfeld and Nicholson?
Oh,
they published your last book.
I found them totally impossible. Very unprofessional. In fact, they finally fired me. They said this book was subversive. They couldn't, couldn't publish.
This book?
Publish such, because the Spanish call it mierda.
Well, you know, they're going through a tough time. They were pretty heavily bankrolled at the beginning, and I keep reading in Publishers Weekly and in the Times that they're having a lot of problems, and they're afraid to they might have taken risk at the beginning.
Risk. Oh, really?
And they want, this is my understanding.
Well, they no longer exist, Weidenfeld and Nicholson.
Well, they're Grove Weidenfeld and
Nicholson. Yeah, but that's a different publisher, really.
Well, it's part of that Getty empire, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's still part of the same group.
Yes.
I think they consolidated Grove with the Grove publisher. Did you ever publish with Grove, by the way?
Never. Yeah. Well, they did publish stories in Evergreen Review.
Mm-hmm.
They published my first story there.
Barney Rossett.
Yeah, he was excellent.
Yeah. So they, you know, the story with Grove, they Barney Rossett sold it to Weidenfeld and Nicholson. And,
right.
He was to stay on as editor-in-chief, and they fired him.
Yeah, well, they fired me, too.
And then he sued them again. They finally had an out-of-court settlement. Barney,
right.
Barney did take a lot of risk. You know, he was the one who brought Lady Chatterley's Lover into this
country. Right, and Henry Miller, some of his.
And Henry Miller. And of course, he was arrested as a pornographer, and he took it to court, and he won.
Good.
You know, we all...
No, he was an important person in publishing.
He's starting his new imprint now.
Oh, good. But I'm not very fond of New York publishers. I'm very happy with California, with City Lights.
Well, you really have had kind of a touch and go with relationship with publishers all your professional life, haven't you?
Yes, they would never publish me in this country. I had to be published in England. Then they got interested.
Initially, And you're still.
And this was published in England first.
That's right.
Because it was called Subversive by these very noble, high-minded New York publishers.
What do they mean by subversive?
I have no idea. I think it means that it's about real people. And I think many people don't like to hear New York criticized. But you see, the criticisms here are coming through my characters. Because if I wrote what I really thought about New York, I would probably be arrested.
Now, wait a minute. A moment ago, you said that the character in the book spoke for himself about New York, and that was
That's true.
Represent the way
it's
you
true.
Felt.
No, in this book, there's nothing that I ever said about New York. But if I did write it, I don't know if they'd publish it.
Well, if you did write it, what would you say?
Well, I would tell some of my own experiences in New York and. You know, about landlords and so on and so forth. And you see, I was really so wrapped up in these characters, I didn't have to tell anything that I thought. I was so busy having them speak that that's all the energy I had. And anyhow, I always like to write about other people. I don't like to write about myself. But in a way, I think the writer is all of these characters. In the sense that he's poured so much energy into creating them from their models that they sort of become him, too.
Yeah. Well, you've lived in New York, for, what, 30?
20, almost 30 years,
almost 30
yes.
Years.
Yeah.
Do you ever miss, you grew up in Ohio, do you miss the Midwest at all?
No.
They have beautiful
it's
winters.
So changed.
They have wonderful winters in the Midwest.
They do. The real thing. But I've lived in the South a lot, too.
Oh, whereabouts?
I lived in Mississippi, in Virginia, and West Virginia.
Where in West Virginia?
Well, Roncesvalles.
Why? What took you down there?
Well, I taught school down there. I was also in the Army in Mississippi, and I really got a lot out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have friends in Alabama I visit there. So I do know the South pretty well.
My mother's name is also Purdy. What kind of name is that? Is that a wasp name?
It's French. Huguenot.
Oh, is that right?
It was what they call an oath name. They swear, par Dieu, I swear by God. Evidently, the Huguenots said that often.
I didn't know my mother was a Huguenot.
Well, she must have been originally. I mean, her ancestors, yes.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
I just thought I came from some
French
sort of
Huguenot.
Wasp family.
Well, they were Protestants, of course, Huguenots. So they were driven out of France when they weren't murdered. And then they went to, I believe they went to Scotland, too.
Well, you grew up in a small town in Ohio, isn't that right?
Several
small towns. Yeah. What town were you born in?
I wasn't born in a town. I was born right out in the country. My family had a farm out there, farmhouse, and they weren't farmers anymore. So it was near the...
So you actually born at home?
Yeah, right.
A midwife, or a doctor, or what?
No, a doctor.
The doctor came to call.
Uh-huh.
So you were born on a farm. Where was the farm?
It was near the Indiana border, and I think the nearest town in Ohio was called Paulding.
So you grew up in small towns in Ohio?
Yeah.
What was your family like?
Well, my... That's a big question.
Well, the reason I ask it is there's a reason for it. It's not just to pry, because I wanted to know what kind of background you had in terms of your literary interest and what sort of influences you might have had from your family.
Well, my parents could read, of course. They read a lot. My mother would read to me from the Bible. So I went to a Calvinist church where they made you memorize everything in the Bible. So I think that had a very good influence, so I didn't like it at the time. But it teaches you the English language, which is the King James Version of the Bible, and that sort of gets into your blood. I think without that, I would have been a poorer writer.
So you had a religious household.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't know whether they were really religious, but they read the Bible, which is a source of everything, you know.
What did you ever think as you were growing up in these small Ohio towns that you would ever one day write yourself?
Well, I wrote things as a child, which my mother found very upsetting. So I guess I was beginning without knowing that was writing, that I was writing it then.
What upset her?
Well, I would write about, just they were for myself, you know, these little stories about people we knew, and she didn't know what to make of them. She thought they were peculiarly accurate, I guess.
I wonder if she were to read Garments of Living Wear, what she would think now.
Well, I don't think she knows those people.
But, you know, in Garments... Jesus Christ appears in the book.
Yes.
So, do you consider yourself a religious man today?
I certainly am in touch with Jesus Christ and all those other people, but they're to me like living people, you know, rather than as gods.
Well, what do you mean by keep in touch?
Well, I can see Jesus in people in New York. You know, like the young evangelist. And I see him in the derelicts, so our government allows to die on the streets. And also the Old Testament is one of the most influential books, I think, on a writer, if he's read it.
When you say you see Jesus in and the derelicts that the government allows to die on the street, are you saying that you actually can see goodness in these people that society, in a way, has discarded?
Well, I think when you read about Jesus and his disciples, those people were so close in touch with life, you know, not with money or respectability or hypocrisy, that I see them in many of the derelicts and the poor. Who are forced, you might say, by their situation to be in touch with life rather than with making money and cheating other people.
But many of the derelicts are, you know, there's this program that the government started a few years ago to remove mentally ill people from hospitals, because theoretically the mentally ill could live by themselves in group homes or in SROs and take their miracle drugs and everything would be all right. And so you saw this terrible influx of of obviously mentally ill people on the street. But I mean, it's a disgrace.
This oh, yeah.
Absolute disgrace.
It's like India.
Many of these people should never be allowed to walk around and build little shacks and parks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is not normal.
No.
And to allow the situation to go on, these drugs aren't working, and they're not getting the follow-up treatment and care. It's I don't mean to get them. That's one of my my soapboxes.
Yeah, well, it's good.
You yourself, you have made a lot of sacrifices, haven't you, in order to pursue your art?
Oh yes, I've never been considered a successful writer.
Well, that's not true. That's not true.
By the establishment.
You mean successful in the sense that Irving Stone was successful, or Irving Wallace, or Jerome Robbins.
Well, I could name other writers too. I'm not going to name them that are always considered by the establishment as more important than I am, because they still regard me as not quite respectable. Why, I don't know. But
well, I put you in my in the category with writers like John Hawkes. There is a category of writers such as yourself. These writers do elegant pieces of work, and some of them, have been unappreciated. I don't think there's any question. John Hawkes is one who has been unappreciated, and he's really gotten screwed by his publishers. I mean, one of his books a couple of years ago, and I have not interviewed John Hawkes, but I know the story. Within a month and a half or 2 months, the publisher removed the book almost before it had a chance to even raise any dust in the bookstores, and remaindered the book before it had a chance.
What publisher was it?
Don't hold me to this.
No.
I think it was Viking.
Yeah, well, they're that way.
But I don't. I shouldn't have said that, because I'm not sure. It's kind of in the back of my
head. See, I had that publisher, and they would not promote the book. They let the book promote itself. They wouldn't do anything that promotes a book.
They never do.
No, they're... I remember once on a Fifth Avenue bookstore, they asked me to come in there and sign books, and they told me they had called Viking, and Viking said, no, we don't put any money into that.
What's to put money in?
Go to a bookstore? Well, they wanted a little cardboard sign. They wouldn't pay for that. So... No, I found that publisher very bad. Well, they've also fired all my editors, 1, 2, 3, 4. Sure. So that you were finally dealing with, can you imagine, it's like being operated on by a surgeon and then the surgeon's fired during the operation.
No, you've gone through a lot of publishers, and I bet nobody at any publishing house that you ever worked with is still there.
No, they're not.
I bet you.
No. Except Farrar and Straus and Giroux, but...
They're a little more stable than most. That's true.
Well, they were very cheap, though. They didn't want to pay.
Well, they were always. Well, yes, they've always cut corners.
Yeah, they liked you if you were starving to death. They said, "Well, don't feed him because then he might be nasty."
Now, James, James. Now here, you I hate to say this, but you've knocked a Viking and Weidenfeld and Nicholson.
Yeah,
and
I knocked all of them.
And Giroux, but I mean, yeah, but you're biting the hands that have fed you, so to speak.
Well, they never fed me.
What if you want to go back to them?
Oh, I don't want to go back.
Yeah, but don't you know that 25 years ago, there may have been 75 hardcover publishing houses publishing fiction, and maybe there are 20 or 25 today.
It's too many.
You're running out of... But you're running out of publishing houses.
Well, that's all right. I first published myself, you know.
That's true.
Also published my first book of poems, The Running Sun. No one wanted it. Now it costs $200 a copy. If you can find it, there are no copies, though. So.
Well, I have your first two self... Well, I guess they weren't self-published, but they were independently published books.
Oh, you mean... Don't Call Me By My Right
That's
Name?
Right.
Yeah. That was published by a very wealthy man who wrote a book on Henry James. He was a businessman, but he had this other... He couldn't understand why anyone had never published these stories. He asked me why. I said, I have no idea why. So he published them, and they fell into the hands of Edith Sitwell. She got the British published. That's how he began.
Yeah. Still... You might want to go back someday. You might, when you finish this new novel, what are you going to do?
Well, City Lights, they're still in business.
If they're still in business. that's the point, you know.
It's true what you say, but I can't worry about it.
No, but you really, you know, I guess what you're saying is I'm going to give myself to my art, and then I'm going to finish it and then see what happens.
Well, I would love to stay with a publisher that believed in me and that paid me something, but I never met one. They not only were totally uninterested in me, but they didn't want to give me enough to live on.
You know, you are not alone in this complaint.
Well, I hope not. I always feel I am.
I know. It's well, whoever said that that being a writer is an easy racket?
Well, also, you can say this, who needs writing, you know, and you can say that because it's not bread. And
who needs writing?
Yeah.
Well, I need it.
Good. But I mean, as a writer, you almost have to force yourself on others. It's like Coleridge's poem, The Ancient Mariner. The Ancient Mariner grabs the wedding guest and shakes him almost, shakes his bones loose. He has to tell him this story. And I think that's the writer. He has to tell a story, and nobody really initially wants to hear it.
You know, I think you're right. What you're saying, I think, if I'm interpreting you correctly, is that you're an artist and you have created a work of art, and you say, here, world, here's my work of art, and you're giving it to an uncaring public.
Right.
They don't care. The public doesn't care.
Never did.
No.
Look how they treated Whitman and Melville. Now they're saints in our, you know, they're saintly, but they were treated like lepers in their day.
Well, I have to say that most writers have the same complaint that you have and the same problem. Once in a while, someone bursts through and becomes a celebrity and this sort of thing. And I'm talking about the literary writers now. I'm not talking about the commercial pulp
writers.
Well,
I think I gradually realized, though I'd been crucified to begin with, so. But having come off the cross, I realized they were never going to be interested in me, and I gave up worrying about it.
Well, you have your niche in the in literary history. There's no question about that. And I'm very proud to have been able not only to know you, but to have been able to read your work. And this is a charming book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your interest.
And it reads so beautifully.
Oh, good. Thank you.
James Hardy, thank you very much.
And I'm glad you have now the British edition, because that is the first edition.
So am I.